Hello and welcome to episode 147 of Tea or Books. I'm Rachel.
I'm Simon.
And today we are going to be starting off by talking about quality versus quantity. Is it better? And this is like thinking about over a year in our reading. Do we feel it's better to have read as many books as we possibly can with as much breadth as we can? Or do we think it's better to read fewer books of better quality, more considered? And in the second part of our podcast, we're going to be talking about two books that we chose from each other's top 10 lists from last year's reading. So that's Blue Postcards by Douglas Bruton and Voyaging Out, British Women Artists from Suffrage to the 60s by Carolyn Trant. So first of all, Simon, how are you? What are you reading?
Yeah, I am very well, thank you. Enjoying that spring finally seems to be in the air a bit today. It's a lovely day today after the endless winter. And I've not done much reading in the last week or so because I've been so busy, but I am rereading The Spring House by Cynthia Asquith because, drum roll, It will be coming out with the British Library Women Writers Series in June. I think we are aiming for spring with spring in the title, but did not manage that in the schedules. Not to be confused with The Spring Begins by Catherine Dunning, also in the series. So yeah, The Spring House is actually set over quite a protracted period. It's called The Spring House because they often meet in somewhere that is actually a summer house but is known as spring house. It's a weird title, but it's about a wealthy young woman whose husband is away in Canada during the war. He's not doing active fighting, obviously, because it's Canada, but he seems to be sequestered there for some reason. It says World War One, I should say, although published 20 or so years later. And it's her big stately home thing that she lives in is being used as a hospital, and she's got various funny friends and relatives. It's quite witty, but then she meets a man that she almost instantly falls in love with. And what is interesting about it is that it's not really like a moral quandary novel. There doesn't really seem to be any thought that, I mean, she clearly, even before she met this new man, didn't think much of her husband. She was sort of raced into marriage very young and didn't spend much time with him before he went away, and they not really a meeting of minds or meeting of anything else particularly. Which is, here I thought it'd be much more about like, oh gosh, is it okay to be in love with this man, which it isn't really. It's more just a description of that experience, although that's the second half really. There's enough in the first half about her nursing or attempting to deal with the various difficult and or funny people around her, but I guess the plot doesn't really matter. What makes it such a special book in my mind is what a vivid and vital character she is. I think I wrote in my review when I first read it a couple of years ago that the idea that only a handful of living people have met her just seems almost blasphemous. She's as lively as an Elizabeth Bennet or something. I think she's the sort of character I just really want people to meet. And I guess like any of Austen's characters, you see any number of flaws, but you can't help being fascinated and caring about them and all that sort of thing at the same time. So a high standard to meet, but I think it's an exceptionally good book. And Cynthia Asquith now is known mostly for her ghost story anthologies, but she did write a couple of novels as well. So I'm really glad we're bringing one of those back.
Well, it sounds very exciting. I remember you talking about it before and you saying how you wax lyrical about it, and then we're like, oh yeah, but it's impossible to get hold of at the end. So I was like, well, thank you. So I'm glad that we're going to all be able to read it very shortly. That's great. It's a shame it's not quite in spring. No, is June? Yeah. No, June is officially the summer, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah, sadly. But go and look up the cover. It is beautiful. It's got these lovely flowers and things on it, which spring, that's not the most evocative description, is it? but it is.
I'm up right now. I can't see images for it.
It's
lovely. The very nice design, actually.
Yeah, they're getting better and better, the designs, I think. Yeah, really like.
Lovely. Well done, you bringing it to their attention.
Yes, I did think it wouldn't really qualify for British Library because it is set before it was written, but we decided we like it too much not to do that. What are you reading?
Well, I've just finished reading yesterday on the train, The Party by Tessa Hadley, which certainly in the UK has been advertised quite a lot over the last few months. It's a novella. My sister got it for me for Christmas. And Yeah, I mean, I've never read any of her books before. I was interested actually, and my sister, one of the reasons why my sister got it was on the front, it had quotations from Hilary Mantel and Kate Atkinson saying about how much they love her as a writer, and they are two writers I love. And I've literally never come across her stuff before. So I was intrigued to try it. It's about two sisters living in Bristol just after World War II, and it's only 100 pages long, so it's very brief. And it's about a party that they go to at the beginning of the book in a pub. It's very evocatively described, actually, a pub amongst the ruins of the docks. And it's kind of still falling apart, and half of its rooms are still bomb damaged and so on. And at this party, they meet these two men, and that goes on to form an experience for them that will change both of, well, not necessarily change both of their lives massively, but that will, I don't know, give them a new outlook on things. It was enjoyable. I enjoyed the period detail. It's been a while since I've read a World War II novel. So yeah, I did enjoy that. But as we've discussed before many times, I think for me, when I read a wartime novel, I always prefer to read one actually written during the war genuinely rather than a kind of a historical novel personally. And I did kind of think like, oh, I feel like this would have been better if it was written by someone in the actual 1940s. But, you know, there we are.
Yes, more on that on the next episode, I guess.
Yeah, because we will be talking about the party.
I thought I had read something by her, but I'm looking her up and it's none of those there. It was something about a coat, the overcoat, or I don't know, something. It wasn't by her. Someone like,
novelist I feel like both of us should have read.
Yes, probably. So, you have now and I can rectify it.
Yeah. There we are. And I should also say, shout out to our podcast friend Greer, who hosted me very kindly in Portland over the summer. She was in London a couple of weeks ago, and I took her to the theatre. We went to see All My Sons. And it was lovely to see her over here. The network of friendships, international friendships that the podcast has created is just wonderful.
Oh, that's lovely. I'm glad, glad you managed to do that.
Yeah, lovely to see her. Okay, so should we get started with these two books now? Kind of a bit of a different vibe for us, because one of these is non-fiction and one is fiction.
Rachel, I don't know if this is the first time you've listened to the podcast, but we do the books in the second half.
Of course we do. Yeah, sorry. I got carried away this, because it's in front of me and I'm thinking about I need to not have it in front of me. Okay. You know what? I've been off school for a week because it's half term and my brain has died. That's what.
Well, I'm excited to see where I go. Well, yes, but what we are going to talk about first is, as you said in the introduction, quality versus quantity. And I suggested this after reading a Guardian article that came out, I think, yesterday as we record, which was basically about reading goals for the year. Obviously, a bit late in the year for setting reading goals for the year, but asking various people, do you have a goal? If you do, what is it? Is it a numerical one? Is it about reading more broadly? Is it, I guess any number of goals. But they also, in each interview, they asked people how many books they'd read last year. And it went from, I think someone very intentionally read 10 books that year. We can talk about that idea of just really, really slowing down, through to, I think the most someone had read was like 2,000 or something ridiculous. Maybe it wasn't that many. But it was an awful lot.
Been doing anything else with your life to do that, surely.
And it was their job. They were basically researching, I think this was the right person. There's someone who was researching a book about romance novels, and so essentially was just reading romance novels all the time.
I mean, if it was my job to just read books, which it partially is, but then I would read way more than I do.
Well, yes. I mean, I suppose at one point when I was doing my doctorate, it sort of was, but I read lots of bits of different books, which didn't tend to count the same. Yeah. but you were telling me it's a special year this year, Rachel.
It is a special year. So the British government has declared 2026 the National Year of Reading. And I know about this because they have put a particular focus on schools. So they have given lots of money to schools in the UK to get children reading. And they did a poll And the average number of books read by an adult in the UK, once everything's sort of aggregated out properly, is 4 a year.
Oh, wow.
And yes, which I was quite shocked by, but I asked my students, I asked a range of different ages of students what they thought the average was. And in fact, a lot of them thought it was lower than that. So I thought that was quite interesting because they don't read very much themselves. And most of the students at school said the only books they read were books that they had to read for school.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
And we have a great school library. We have an amazing school librarian. She really kind of does a lot to push reading. So we do have some kids who read a lot, but the majority of children aren't reading very much at all. The government's very concerned about this. And they're kind of looking at it from two prongs, which I think is quite interesting. So the first prong is that they're kind of really selling the mental health benefits of reading, wanting people to read because it's proven to make us happier, more content. So encouraging people to kind of find their interest and to develop a passion through reading and reading about the things that they find interesting. And then the second prong is to improve literacy levels, because a lot of employers are complaining that even after people are coming into the workplace having gained an undergraduate degree, they are essentially functionally illiterate when they go into the workplace. You know, they can't write an email accurately. They can't read complex contracts and things. It's becoming a real concern. So there's this big push to get people reading, and not just reading more, but reading intentionally, in terms of, okay, so maybe reading isn't your thing, but let's say you're into, I don't know, racing driving. Why don't you read, rather than just read a magazine, why don't you read an autobiography of a racing driver or something like that? And the idea is kind of getting people to pick up stuff that speaks to them, rather than, you know, doing the whole, oh, well, you've got to read 10 classic books, because that's what makes people feel a little bit intimidated sometimes. So I think it's exciting that, and I think it's great as well that money is being invested in this, because you know, I think reading has become, in our social media age, sadly neglected. Though what's interesting is that bookshops are making more money. So people are buying books. But
that's interesting.
But people aren't reading. So these two things don't, I mean, there must be a kind of certain subset of people who are reading a lot, and then the majority of people and buying a lot, and then the majority of people not. So it's interesting, and I just think that I was shocked by that 4 book statistic, and I just thought to myself, gosh, how could you only read 4 books a year? But then a lot of people just read on holiday, I think.
Yeah, I mean, my guess is there's probably not that many people who are reading 4 books a year. There's probably a lot of people who are reading no books a year, and then a lot of people who are reading 20, 30, 40, 50, whatever, and it's, yeah, coming down to that average. But because, yeah, it would be strange to me to be the sort of person who buys or borrows books and reads them and then only reads 4. I can sort of see why someone would read none. I mean, obviously, not why. But I can see, I know people who don't read any books, but I guess I don't know many people who would only read 4 a year. Although I was having a conversation with my friend and colleague, Susanna, who sometimes listens to the podcast. So apologies for what I'm about to say, Susanna. But we've got very similar tastes. We've recommended books to each other. She really loves Oh, the Brave Music. That's one of the things we bonded over. And then I discovered, after maybe like 3 years of swapping recommendations, that she reads like 8 to 10 books a year. And I was like, Susanna, why am I listening to your recommendations? You're not a reader. And then I felt very bad. We were trying to find, actually, in that conversation, the number of books you read a year that would make you count as a reader. And I recognize it's a very problematic thing to do. But I came down on the number 52. I thought, if you're reading a book a week, I'll count you as a reader. But then I changed it. We settled on changing the term to bookworm, and then we allowed that rather than just reader.
Because, I mean, the book a week is quite a lot, I would say.
I know, I felt bad about this, but yeah. Well, should we set out our stall to start with? Do you know how many books you read last year?
I do. I think I read about 55, and for me that was...
You counted, you're in the category, great.
Yeah, I'm in, I'm okay. And But I find what's interesting when I look, because obviously we do our episode every year where we look at our favourites, and when I look back and see my patterns of reading, I do, most of my reading is concentrated around school holidays. So during term time, for example, like last term, I probably read one book in the space of 5 weeks that wasn't for school, because I'm reading books all the time for school, but I often only read it, I've already read it, and I'll be reading a chapter at a time. So I might be doing that in the evening, which means I then can't read another book because I haven't got time to do both. When I get to the school holidays, so like for example in the summer when I've got 8 weeks off, I'll often read easily 20 or 30 books in that time. Because I'm traveling, I'm on planes, I'm on trains, I'm on so on. So I think for me it's a real kind of peaks and troughs throughout the year of stuff that I'm reading, and often it will take me a very long time to read something during term time, and I'll only read a few pages a day, whereas in the summer or in other breaks, Christmas break, I will read, like, I can easily read a book in a day.
Yeah,
so it's very different experiences.
And I read 122 print books, and I listened to 94 audiobooks. I don't know if audiobooks count in the year of reading, but so I gave my total as 216, but only 122 print books, which I guess, yeah. So what's that? 2.5 a week.
That's amazing. Yeah. I don't know how you do it, actually.
Well, I was thinking about this the other day, partly I, like you, I'm a fast reader, and that makes a big difference.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking, say the average book I read is 300 pages long. That for me, that is 5 hours of reading. And if I'm doing, like, I usually spend my lunch break reading, and maybe I'll do an hour in the evening. So I can get through a book in like 2.5 days based on that. And then I guess I spend some weekends doing more reading. I read some shorter books, all that sort of thing. So I think it's just the fit that for me, my default is like, if I'm not doing something else, then I'm reading. Whereas other people's default is like, if they're not doing something else, then they're, running or watching TV or doing sport or knitting or any number of other very, very noble activities. But it's, sort of my neutral baseline. And it's one of those numbers, 260, again, let's not count audiobooks just for the purposes of this. But 122, when I say that in normal places like my workplace, that people are taken aback by that. When I talk about that on like book Twitter or something, that's a quite normal number. So I get not beguiled, but like I forget how unusual it is to read quite as much as I do when I'm talking to people who read a handful of books a year, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that is very unusual. And I think it's really challenging for a lot of people with their work, their lives, and the times when a lot of people do read would be like when they're commuting, before they go to bed, etc. But there's certain kind of phases of life, I suppose, when it's more challenging. It's really hard to read before bed if you're a parent and you've got to get your kids to bed. The evening is just one thing after another. Or like someone like me, I walk to work, so, and I can't do audio bits because they just don't go in. So I have an hours of commuting a day that I can't do anything else with. And obviously I also have a job that bleeds into the evenings. So I don't have time to read I read for a little bit before I go to bed, but like I say, often I'm having to read what I'm doing for school. So I don't have time to read. I mean, the irony is you'd think an English teacher would be reading all the time, and it's like most of my colleagues and I are just like, when do we have time to read what we actually want to read? That's the pressure. But I think it's interesting though as well to think about what people are reading, and it's, we're talking about quality of reading. I've got lots of friends who, when they do read, they're like, oh, I just want to read something mindless. I don't want to have to think.
Mm-hmm.
And so they buy, the kind of crime novels that I don't really read. I can't think of any of the authors, but I
like the Freda McFadden sort of thing.
And they all look the same, don't they? those books that are like sort of airport style books, holiday reads, books that, which, I'm not saying that in a judgmental way. I think, as I always say to my kids at school, all reading is good reading. Like, I'm not bothered by what people choose to read. But it's like they're not reading because they're like, oh, I really want to enrich my mind. I want to learn new vocabulary. I want to learn about something new. I want to, you know, I want to read this classic that I've never heard of. I wanted to do it. It's like, I'm reading to switch off.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I don't necessarily read for that reason.
Yeah, it's interesting. And yeah, I should, as you say, I should acknowledge that even the question of quality versus quantity is obviously a luxury position. If there's people who, yeah, you know, working three jobs and have got three kids under five or whatever, like any reading you can squeeze in is amazing. Yeah. But I have a lot of time for reading. So I guess it's more of a choice issue for me. Yeah, and I guess it depends what you mean by quality as well, doesn't it? Because quality could be like what is widely agreed to be the best literature, or it could be books that I really enjoy. Like I consider it a success if I got to the end, it's like, yeah, that's a 5-star read for me. And that doesn't necessarily mean it's a brilliant work of literature or that anyone else would think it was a 5-star read. And I guess for me, that's why it's hard for me to know when I pick up a book whether it's a number to add to the quantity or if it's going to be quality, because I don't know how much I'm going to like that book. I mean, I might know that it's an author I've liked before or a book that I'm thinking to get to, but or indeed that it's a classic, but I can't pick something off the shelf and think, yes, I'm adding to my quality necessarily. It might be a gap in my reading of classics and then I've got more of a guide, but if I get to the end of that and haven't enjoyed it, mm-hmm, I don't think I'd necessarily be able to add that as a quality read. It, for example, I just recently gave up on If on a Winter's Night, A Traveller by Italo Calvino, which is revered and lots of people love it and both critical and indeed commercial success, and I hated it and gave up after 100 pages, and that's been on my shelf for like 15 years or something, waiting for like, yes, this will improve my mind at some point. I also thought I'd enjoy it, and I have enjoyed one other book by him, but yeah, that was one I picked up thinking quality and ended up, well, not even finishing it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I mean, a lot of people who perhaps aren't readers will often go to, like, when they decide, oh, I want to read something or I want to challenge myself, they'll go to those kind of book lists, like, you know, the top 100 mm-hmm books you must read in a lifetime. And it's always like, you know, number one, War and Peace, number two. And it's like, right, okay, I've got this 1,000 page book that I'm expected mm-hmm to read. And you start reading it, and it's like, you know, is this book really going to, like, if you don't enjoy it, then, or like you don't get into it, it's people can then feel bad about themselves, and then that can, you know, switch them off reading even more if they think, oh well, you know, I was supposed to really enjoy this and maybe I'm stupid or I don't get it or whatever. And I think we can put too much pressure on that idea of quality in terms of, you know, this book is going to change your life, it's going to enrich your mind, it's going to mean that you can have conversations about this and that and the other. And I think perhaps in the past, when there was more of a shared reading, a kind of a community in the sense of, you know, there were fewer books around and there was a more of perhaps a shared consensus about what the major classics of English literature were, and, you know, most people would go to school and study those particular books, and then you'd have that commonality that you could talk to people about things. But I don't think necessarily in the 21st century it's people have got that shared reading history now. So if you haven't read War and Peace, it's not going to mean that you're shut out of conversations or
no.
Won't get references to things in a way that perhaps you might not have done 60 years ago, if you see what I mean. And so I think that idea of quality in terms of having to read those books in order to be educated or, you know, sophisticated in some way, I think is being challenged now. I think that's a good thing. You know, I really encourage people, and I say this to my students as well, is like to make your own lists of books that you feel interested in, that you want to find out more about, writers that you like, topics that you like, and make your own list for the year. You know, like if I've read these three books about, I don't know, mushrooms or whatever, because I'm really into fungi, then I'm going to feel like I've really achieved something this year, rather than being like, oh, I've got to read these three classics, and if I haven't done it, then I'm a failure, and you're sort of wading through these books that you don't feel connected to or don't feel interested in. So for me, like when I'm thinking about quality reading during the year, it's like I want to read stuff that allows me to explore what I'm interested in at this point in my life. Which is why, you know, for both of us, we have many unread books on our shelves. And I don't feel pressured by that, because I'm like, their time will come, because I've bought it, because I know I'm interested in this topic, but I'm maybe not ready to delve into it right now. But then when I am, oh my goodness, look, I've got 7 books about female members of the Royal Navy or something. I mean, I don't, but you know, the kind of thing I would have. And now, you know, I've collected them over the years, and now I'm ready. And my quality reading for this year is I want to read all of these books and really develop my understanding about this over the course of the year. And if those were the only 7 books that I've read, I'd be very happy with that. I don't think about my reading over the course of the year as a number. What I do think about is, I feel often I'll have a pile of books that have just built up. They get just, my kitchen, there's like a little area in my kitchen that just gets the books dumped on, and gradually the pile grows. And that for me is like, I have to get through that pile by the end of the year. And if I've done that, then I'm fine. So Christmas holidays becomes a race to finish that pile.
I have actually just read a book about mushrooms. So they get, well, in fact, it was The Mushroom Tapes by Helen Garner and a couple other people. I forget about the mushroom poisoning in Australia, but I'll read any nonfiction by Helen Garner. So
that was fascinating, wasn't it?
Yeah, and she's always got such an interesting slant on anything. She really gets it. Yeah, she's always got an interesting angle. I think that's all really, really great stuff. And it reminds me of, again, in this article, it talked about Storygraph, and I've never used Storygraph, but it's like an alternative to Goodreads. I use Library Thing, which is another independent alternative if you don't want to use Amazon owned things. But Storygraph apparently lets you set goals that aren't just, you know, number of books per year, but you can say, you can still do numerical things like number of pages per year if you want to, you know, if you're the sort of person who tends to read books over 800 pages long or whatever. But also you can set goals around, I think, well, I'm just guessing here, but it was a bit like number of countries I've read from, or diversity of authors, or diversity of periods, or any of these other things that can be considered quality. Because, you know, there's always people, including us, I'm sure, who want to read more diversity or read about different worlds that we don't know. And if it's, that's, I guess, the problem I have with setting a goal of number. I do read a lot of books, but I never set a goal. And I know Goodreads is very big on you set your number of books you want to read. Because, I mean, anyone can read 100 books a year if you just read Beatrix Potter or something. Like, yeah, it's not hard to get through 100 children's books. And I'm sure there's plenty of people listening who've read the same children's book 100 times this year. So they could certainly put that down. But I think I am keen to read a lot, and I do things like a book a day in May, where I want to just get more of the books off my shelf. I don't care what the number is at the end of the year. I mean, I'd be sad if it was like half what I'd read the previous year or something, but I never set a number goal. And for me, it's sort of slightly a false division, because, as I say, like, I don't know the quality of the book until I've read it. And the reason I want to read so many books is to try and find as many that I love as possible. And I think, you know, I might get to the end of the year and probably I will have read, I normally read maybe like 20, 30 books a year that I would say, yes, these are really brilliant and I'm really pleased to read them. Maybe even fewer, maybe like 15 or something, that are like the ones that I absolutely loved. But if I only read 50 books a year, then I might only have read half of those amazing books. So it's, for me, it's sort of like I'm treasure hunting or like padding for gold or something. And to pan for gold, I have to get as much, I don't understand how gold panning works, as much of the river in as possible. Is that how gold panning works?
I think that sounds about right, doesn't it?
Yeah. If it is, and then I think that's a lovely metaphor.
As river as you can.
Yeah.
I think it's, you know, I think that's a very good point. I mean, the reality is, a lot of what you read, you've got no idea whether you're going to like it or not. And so you are essentially, even if it were a classic, you know, there's no, even if everybody thinks it's amazing, you might not. So it's, everything is a kind of punt to a degree. And the more you read, the more likely you are to find the quality stuff that really speaks to you, and that you find enriching. And I think that's why I read so much over the course of the year. I mean, number one is because I love reading, but number two is because I feel like I've I want to kind of experience as much as I can and read as much as I can and find as many new authors as I can. And, you know, and often I'm curious, you know, it's because lots of people have said, this writer's really good, I think you'd really like them, and I want to see for myself. And, you know, sometimes I agree and sometimes I don't, that's okay. But if you don't read a large volume, then you aren't going to be able to find the treasures. And I'm the same as you. I get to the end of the year list when I look at, you know, I've read obviously a much smaller proportion of books than you. And often I think, do you know what? If I hadn't have read 42 of those books this year, it wouldn't have made any difference to me. And it's
just don't know which 42 it is when you're setting it up.
So I couldn't have pre-written a list and been like, right, I'm going to prioritize these writers this year and they're going to be the ones that are going to be amazing for me, because often I'm disappointed actually. It's hard. So that's why I think if you're going down the route of quality, I think you have to really think about intentionality and considering, well, what do I define as quality, and what does that actually look like in terms of me pre-choosing books? Because I think if you are going to do that, you do sort of have to pre-choose. It's not just about like, oh, I'm going to pick whatever book is out in Waterstones this month or whatever. Like, you have to have some kind of reason for the route you're going down. So I would think it would be quite interesting to do that actually for a year. Maybe I'll do that this year. Maybe that'll be my little target. And then I could report back at the end of the year. I will pre-plan my reading and write a list, because I'm planning on buying any books, and I have been very good and I have not bought any so far.
Oh, well done.
Yeah.
Well, you can set out all our reading for the year for the podcast whilst you're doing it. Because we do not plan ahead. We decide at the beginning of each recording what we're doing for the next episode.
Okay, well, our spontaneity is what makes us strong.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, let's make our choice, quantity or quality. What are you going for?
Well, I think really I would have to say quantity, because if you don't read a lot, then you're not going to get to the quality.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same. I think it's a sort of, I'm searching for the quality, but the only way for me to do that is quantity. So I will have to pick quantity as well. We'd love to hear people's thoughts. You can do get in touch at teaorbooks@gmail.com. And one person who did, what a segue, is Erin. So I got a question from the middle from Erin, which was in early January, which explains this sort of theme. As I said, spring's in the air, but this is about wintry books. Oh. So Erin says, hi, Simon and Rachel. Happy New Year to you both. Thank you, Erin. Hope you two had lovely Christmases. We did. As it snowed only yesterday in our village, what are some of your favourite wintry novels? Snow must be very present. I know this is not the vibe of the podcast, but I really love Tolstoy's short story, Master and Man. So much snow and despair. I've never read any Tolstoy of any description, I'm afraid, Erin. P.S. Currently reading Elizabeth Phair's A Winter Away, which I think we did ages ago.
Yeah.
As the title and cover illustration suggests, snow. On page 108, so far no snow, but really loving, endearingly ridiculous characters, also reading Moominland midwinter to my four-year-old. And of course, it is wonderful. I don't think there was any snow in A Winter Away by the end, was there?
No, I'm not sure there was.
But plenty in Moominland midwinter, which is a lovely book.
I do love those books.
So, can you think of any snowy books? I've got a couple I can go with if you need some time to think.
Yeah, you get started while I think.
So the one I think I've mentioned a few times on here that really, really makes you feel cold as you're reading it, there's so much snow, is The Tenderness of Wolves by Stephen Penny? I forget her exact name. Mm-hmm. That I believe is set in Alaska. And I think it is. And yes. Lots and lots and lots of snow. And I think there's obviously more to the plot than the snow, but it is the thing that really conveyed coldness to me the most. The other one I will pick is There Is Some Snow in Told in Winter, also published as A Winter's Tale by John Godden, the sister of Rumor Godden. And that's a really, really good book about this sort of quite damaging, fraught relationship between a writer and this sort of ingenue who turns up as devoted to him, but it's the dog is the main character, really. I would say interesting dog in it. And actually, whilst I've been talking, I've also thought of The Snow Child by Owen Evie, which is a retelling of I think it's maybe a Russian fairy tale, but an old fairy tale about a childless couple who form a child out of snow who then comes to life. And it's such a moving, beautiful book. And obviously snow, very central to that. And I think that's also set in Alaska.
Oh.
If these things aren't Alaska, then they are like cold parts of Canada, but I think they are Alaska. Has that given you enough time to come up with some snowy books?
Yes. Well, I saw one of my favourite sort of winter reads is the Miss Reed Thrush Green books. And Winter in Thrush Green is a lovely snowy book that I highly recommend. And the good thing about those books is you kind of like, it's nice to read them in order, but you don't need to. Like they tell you all that you need to know in the books. So that's a really nice one. I cannot obviously resist mentioning the wonderful snowy scene in Emma by Jane Austen, which is the wonderful moment when Emma is trapped in the carriage with Mr. Elton, and he declares his love for her after their Christmas party. So that's always enjoyable to read in the winter. In fact, enjoyable to read any time of the year.
Any time of day or night.
there's a moment in there that covers every season. So what a joy.
That's our challenge for your questions for the future. Can you find a question that Rachel can't answer with Emma? Can anyone do it? I don't know.
I think it would be a very hard task. there's also The Life After Life, which starts on a snowy Christmas Eve by Kate Atkinson, a wonderful novel. Oh, and my favourite of the Laura Ingalls Wilder Little House on the Prairie books, which is The Long Winter, which is, if you want to feel cold, that book is going to make you feel cold.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Thanks for the question, Erin. Sorry that we didn't record an episode for quite a while after you sent it. So by now you might not be looking for snow as much. But having said that, this week has been pretty bitterly cold until the last couple of days. So yeah, you never know. Snow could still be around the corner.
It could.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And indeed, if you live in Alaska, I'm sure it's very snowy right now.
Yes.
Well, Rachel, since you've already done it once, do you want to introduce the books again?
Yes. So we are doing the two books from our individual top tens of 2025 reading. So one of my top tens that you chose was Voyaging Out, British Women Artists from Suffrage to the 60s by Carolyn Trant. So that's a non-fiction exploration of female artists. And then your choice, my choice of your choice, is Blue Postcards by Douglas Bruton, which is a kind of novella that's got a very interesting structure and setup that I'll let you talk more about. So do you want to introduce that and I'll introduce Voyaging Out, or vice versa?
We should do it the other way. We can introduce ones you've just read. Why not?
Okay.
If you're happy to do that.
Oh, that's fine.
So yeah, I can do this. I won't say too much because the subtitle basically covers it, but Voyaging Out, British Women Artists from Suffrage to the 60s, and it does cover, not in chronological order, but in sort of thematic order, enormous number of female artists. It also Trant gives you their milieu, their education, maybe their background, a dizzying number of them. It really wrestles through them. What I particularly like is there are an awful lot of illustrations. So often when you're reading a book about art, you have to be constantly Googling, what do these paintings look like? But this one, even if it's not the exact painting that's being discussed, at least it's usually gives you a sense of their style. And I appreciated that. And yeah, so it covers, well, it starts with about talking about sort of life class and whether, you know, women painting nudes and being nude models, etc., but goes through any number of other things about surrealism and modernism and the influence of women and women artists as teachers, the class issues, female artists who are married to male artists or who their muse, well, any number of topics and, well, in fact, 18 topics looking at the number of chapters. But yeah, an awful lot of, I don't know if it's necessary research. I'm sure there was research, but it also feels just like a lifetime of knowledge and interest in that Trant has put together.
Blue Postcards is kind of, it's interesting, we go backwards and forwards in time, but it's told from the perspective of the narrator who is in Paris And it starts when he goes down to the Bocanides on the Seine, and he sees a girl called Michelle, and she's selling postcards. And he finds a blue postcard, which we find out through the narrative is a postcard that was sent by the artist Yves Klein to advertise his exhibition in Paris. And we move back in time to the narrator's father, who was a tailor and made a suit for Yves Klein. And also then the story of his father and also his grandfather are told also through his own life in his present day Paris. But then, you know, obviously as the narrative progresses, we start to see that perhaps all is not as it may seem. So and we also through that we also have the story of the artist Yves Klein, I might add. So yes, very interesting, and structured as a series of kind of numbered paragraphs rather than as a traditional narrative as well. So an unusual structure. So yeah, where would you like to start?
Ooh, well, to be honest, I'm just dying to know if you liked blue postcards. I'm just going to ask that outright.
I did like it.
Good.
I did love it as much as I wanted to, but I liked it very much. I thought it was a very unusual story. I loved how the different threads, and, you know, obviously a thread is also important in the story, all woven together. I've never read anything quite like it before, so I love how unique it is. And I really enjoyed the story of, and I found it very moving. I found it very moving, the story of his father and his grandfather, of the narrator's father and grandfather. I found the meditations on art and life, and as the novella progresses, this idea of what is truth, what is reality, what is fiction, and really interesting. And I think it's a really intriguing premise for a book. What I didn't understand, and that perhaps it's just me being dense, is why it was structured as it was.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, the structure is what initially drew me to it, because I've mentioned a few times that in the past few years, I've really been drawn to books told in these vignettes. And the thing that really, I think, was it the first one I read? But Department of Speculation by Jenny Offer, which I absolutely loved, set me off on that. And that's not different characters and perspectives and timelines in the way this one is, although it often does go quite sort of abstractly. Like, there'll be a few paragraphs about some sort of scientific discovery that then go back to the main narrative. But then I found any number of others that I haven't always loved them, but it's an approach that really interests me a bit, I guess, to link to the painting theme, a bit like an impressionist painting, where you, or even pointillism or something, where you've got quite disparate things that somehow cohere into an interesting whole, in maybe more interesting photorealism would be. And that's why when I just picked this one up in a bookshop, in Portsmouth, I was just flicking through and thought, oh, it's in vignettes, I'll give that one a go. So that's how it started. So it's hard to know why specific stories need that more than others, but for me it worked well in this one, because it meant there's more of a fluidity between the narratives than if it had just been something like, you know, we both love The Hours by Michael Cunningham, but which similarly has three different plot lines, but those are much more like chapter. Whereas this felt more like you were flowing back and forth between these different people and the different timelines, because you didn't have to wait, I know, 20 pages, whatever, but before going back, you just had to wait a handful of words.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I found that structure really interesting in terms of, you know, that idea of us flitting between different kind of time periods and headspaces and story threads and moments in time. And that I think that was, it did kind of feel a little bit like we were kind of being zoomed into different thoughts, I guess, each time. It was like different, a bit sort of stream of consciousness, really. I suppose for me, I was thinking as I was reading it, I was like, this would have been more interesting if each of these moments was a postcard.
Ooh.
That's what I thought that the book was going to be. I thought each of the things was good, each page was going to be a postcard, and that's why I was looking at those things. So I was, though, saying that, how many postcards did Eve Klein send for the Blue Postcard Exhibition? Because is that why the numbers are what they are?
Ooh, I don't know. It does say how many, but I can't remember what it, how many it was.
No, so
Sorry.
maybe that's what it was. Maybe I should have clicked on that earlier.
Something I was a bit embarrassed that I didn't notice when I read it the first time, but someone told me afterwards, is that the word blue is in every single one of these 500
Yes.
things, which rereading it, it did stand out too much more. And occasionally I will say the word blue seemed to be inserted in a way that didn't quite make sense to the paragraph. But I guess that's just sort of a fun thread. Again, now you've said thread, it's going to be, yes, one of the things is that Henri sews this thread into everyone's suits, this blue thread. And I guess that is the blue thread throughout the vignettes. We'll come back to it. But yes, the other book, as you say, it's unusual for us to do a fiction with a non-fiction. And whilst it is also about art, it is very, very different in what it's trying to do. And I will admit, when I started it, my heart sort of sank as I was reading it because I thought, well, this writing isn't very good. It's just like very staccato writing. But that actually only bothered me for like 2 or 3 pages, and then I just got into the tone of it. And I think, Tran isn't a brilliant prose stylist. She, I think it's not, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was at first. Once I got used to it, she's a very serviceable writer, I think. But her knowledge is extraordinary, and her it is a sort of, objective factual work. She isn't giving really that many like strong opinions about which artists are good and which are bad. But you can see this sort of passion coming through it, for these unsung women. I guess I did think at the end of it, I would love to read a book about like maybe 2 or 3 of these women, because there were so many. And I, there'd be a paragraph on one and that was it, and then you'd move on. And I'm thinking, partly because my knowledge is so threadbare. Gosh, so many thread puns today. So I know so little about art history of any description, let alone the sort of, unsung people in that history, that I knew very, very few of the names. I knew even fewer of the artworks, and I felt kind of just overwhelmed by how much I didn't know and how much I was, then instantly had to move on. So I got to the end thinking, if someone asked me who were some of the, not even major women artists, but some of the women artists, I think, well, I don't know any of them because I've read so many that I've forgotten them all now. But so I enjoyed the experience, but I don't think I learned that much because it was just too much for me to get my head around. But you probably have a better understanding of art history before you started it than I do.
Well, I mean, I like to think so, but I mean, the vast majority of people in this book were very new to me, which, I think says it all, really, doesn't it? About, I just thought it was, and I agree with you, it's a very serviceably written book rather than one that's trying to be beautiful. There's so much information that she's wanting to kind of convey, that actually it does sort of need to be quite serviceable prose. I really liked the thematic chapters and how she sort of separates them out. I really loved also how she celebrates those artists who perhaps weren't ever commercially successful but were doing things, particularly, I really enjoyed the chapter about women art educators who were pioneers in bringing art into primary and secondary schools after the war, and sort of created these new curriculums and pedagogy around teaching art, and a lot of that work and that knowledge and their expertise has been foundational to how art is now taught in schools, but nobody knows who they are, and I just thought that's so sad that they did so much. And just women working together, forming groups together, creating the most amazing art, and often being connected to within the circles of producing work just as good as very famous men, but never having gained the same recognition, largely because often they were having to keep houses and look after children while they were trying to do those things as well. So I think this is a wonderful book to show how much women were held back even up until the 1960s by domesticity, and even often when they worked as part of artistic partnerships with husbands, the majority of the work for the house and the children still fell on them. It was interesting. I was at the Dulwich Picture Gallery today, looking at an exhibition of Anna Anker. He's a Danish artist. He was painting in the early 20th century, late 19th century, and she's a household name in Denmark, but not really known outside. And it was really interesting in the exhibition, they acknowledged that she's the most famous female painter in Denmark. There were many other women painting at the same time as her, but she was quite unique in that she had a very close-knit family who were very supportive of her, who had money and lots of properties. And she had child-free childcare and a husband who supported her in her work. And so that enabled her to paint, whereas there were many other women in her circle who didn't have the same opportunities because they didn't have anyone to look after their children and they didn't have anywhere to paint, or their husbands didn't support them or whatever. So I think she brings that out really well, the idea that women's art has not, from that period of time, hasn't received attention because it's not very good. It's because they didn't have the networks and the opportunities.
Yeah. And something I found really interesting about that is, and this is a really good thing that she did to correct the sort of accepted history, is often she'd say this particular female artist is often thought of as having been influenced by this particular male artist, but actually either it was the other way around, or they're both exploring the same ideas at the same time, or even in collaboration. She's saying it's just been assumed that, yeah, the women are the disciples or the influenced rather than the influencers. I thought that was, yeah, very instructive. I also thought, even if you set aside the misogyny in critical history or the domesticity that you're talking about that has influenced their reception, just it really brings across how aleatory the people we accept as the canon of art is, like, mm-hmm. It was, you know, influenced by what was popular at any one time, or what group let people in, or who exhibited where. And I think we're both obviously very familiar with the canon of literature and how that is accepted as being the great, great things, but we know any number of reasons that keep things out or keep things in that have got nothing to do with the quality of a work. But I think it must be even more so with art, where you're not publishing and disseminating it out to anywhere in the country. You have to have people go and look at it in one particular place at one particular time, which means that someone has to agree to either the artist has the money to do an exhibition themselves, or someone else has to accept it for exhibition. And it does seem much more dependent on these very chance things that, I'm sure the things that are accepted as good are good. Well, not, maybe not all of them, but, you know, things aren't accepted good for no reason. But there's any number of reasons why good things wouldn't even get to the stage of being seen, let alone then accepted as canonical. I thought she did such a good job at finding out about these artists who either like never exhibited or held one exhibition with five other people. I think just extraordinary that she found all these people. I did think it was interesting how often she ended a discussion of an artist by saying, this is the year they had their art accepted into the Tate, or they haven't yet in the Tate. So she's still got an eye on, like, what is the, often it was the Tate, but other sort of national galleries, like which of these have finally accepted them, or, you know, it's clearly still matters to maybe to Trant, or maybe just to the solidity of an artist's reputation, that they do have that sort of stamp of yes, even if you're not on display, you're somewhere in the archive of the Tate, and that is still important in her eyes, it seems.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, that in itself is quite a patriarchal thing, like you need to be accepted by a reputable organization, in order to be called an artist. That's interesting. But I think, you know, it just goes to show as well, like, what I love about books like this is thinking, isn't it wonderful that these archives exist and that there are people who are able to go and find even, you know, the most one person's who's had one exhibition in some village hall in 1937 in some village in the middle of nowhere. Mm. And that's been kept. I just love it. It just makes me think, like, goodness me, it's so fascinating. And I do wonder whether in this day and age when so much stuff is online, like, are we going to have access to all this stuff in the future? I don't know. But it's incredible. The amount of research in this book is just phenomenal. I mean, I would love to go and go to a talk by her, or to kind of just go and see an exhibition that she's curated or something, because I just think, gosh, her knowledge is just incredible.
And that's what, you know, if you go to Blue Postcards again, it's such a different way of presenting an artist's life, because there are more than, there are these three main characters, but Yves Klein is the only one who is real. And obviously, Darkest Bruton has also done an awful lot of research and presented it in such a different way. So we do see like things that Klein did, like an exhibition that was entirely just, you know, empty, an empty room with, you know, a display table or something, you know, actual artwork. He did these painting of sculptures all in this iconic blue colour. He did performance art of him supposedly pausing in midair. I love the way that Bruton wrote about that. And I thought it's fascinating because I got to the end, like, I don't know how much, I'm sure those bare facts are true about what he did at different times, but it's much more of a portraying the personality of this artist as a character, and how much of that is fictional, how much of that is recorded fact, who knows? I don't think it particularly matters for this sort of book, but I definitely felt like I had such a deep, deep sense of who Yves Klein was, even if it's through a filter of fiction, without seeing a single one of his artworks in this book, because there's no painting, there's no illustrations or anything. And obviously such a different way of portraying an artist's life to what Trant's doing, but I thought really effective and interesting and quite honouring. I think something Bruton is always good at throughout this book and the other book I've read by him, he's so interested in humanity and he's such a humane writer that even sort of more eccentric or possibly unpleasant characters in this book, I felt like I knew them deeply through not many words, and I think that's such a skill.
Yeah, I think it is as well. And you know, certainly for me, as I was reading, I was constantly thinking, I wonder if this actually happened. I wonder if you know, these people really existed. I'm like, is this the narrator? Is this his family? You know, is this the, you know, is this the, sorry, not the narrator, you know what I mean? Like the author, is this like really his family story? And yeah, I found it fascinating. It's like you're also seeing how, but through telling the story that way, you're showing how an artist can have a profound impact on people throughout time, within their own lifetime, who they come into contact with, beyond their lifetime, and how art can also bring people together. So yeah, I agree with you. It was fascinating and very clever. I guess the whole time I was reading it, I was just thinking, I'm not really sure why these are numbered, and I wanted to know why, and I couldn't work it out, and I think that perhaps irritated me.
Had you back? Well, yeah. I definitely think you should read Hope Never Knew Horizon, which is again about three people, but they are done in just in sequential chapters, and that is about Emily Dickinson, but through the eyes of her maid. It's about the sort of whale skeleton that used to hang in the British Museum, where she had one hung in, from its sort of discovery onwards, and then about the artwork known as Hope that is painted by Watts. I think, in fact, when I was reading that one, I was like, I love Blue Postcards. I'm glad Rachel's reading it, but I think Hope Never Knew Horizon is much more Rachel's sort of book, so I would really recommend you to to get to that. But I think it just struck me as, again, actually, that, you know, another sort of similarity is that Trant writes about these artists who, they are producing art, so it's not quite the same, but never got fame. And I thought Henri the Tailor is similarly this very artistically minded character, but was never even known as an artist, possibly even to himself in the novel, but does have that artistic view. He's like sewing these threads and he's making clothes, which obviously is increasingly recognized as an art. And I liked that sense of his artistry alongside Yves Klein's much more bombastic artistry, but they're both in their own way artists interacting with each other.
Yes, and you know, interesting that the thread that is his kind of marker is hidden, so
yes,
everyone sees it, but does that mean that it's not worthy? And it's really interesting. And you know, that collect that the narrator as well is an artist, you know, he collects these images, he creates them. So I think there's a lot to be said about what makes an artist, what makes us, what makes a piece of art valuable and what doesn't, and you know, is life just a performance, really?
There you go. Yeah. There you go. Well, really interesting to read those two together. I think they did really talk to each other in an unexpected way. Unsurprisingly, in the TV or books decision making, I will be sticking with one of my favourite reads of last year, Blue Postcards. I'm guessing you might do the same for your book.
Well, I mean, it's actually a very hard decision because I've never read anything like Blue Postcards before, and I did genuinely really enjoy it and look forward to reading it. And I learned a lot from it. I mean, I'd never even heard of Eve Klein before reading it. So, I mean, I had to Google it and was like, oh, it is a real person. Okay. So I did massively enjoy it. But I also love Voyaging Out because I learned so much from that. So, you know, it is actually a very hard decision.
Okay, good.
I think it's a very well-written novel, and I actually did feel quite tearful at the end. Moved me.
Yeah, he's a very moving writer.
So, actually, I mean, I think I will go with Blue Postcards.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, that pleases me. But yeah. I meant to say, actually, two of the artists I looked up, I really want to learn more about, Stella Bowen and Mary Adshead. Those are my two favourites there. I really liked their work. So I'm glad to have been introduced to them particularly. So I'm going to go find out more.
Yeah, there we go. So wonderful. We've both had an artistic education.
Exactly. And in the next episode, as Rachel mentioned, we will be doing The Party by Tessa Hadley, and we'll be doing that with The Dutch House by Anne Patchett.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks, everyone. Do get in touch at tourbooks@gmail.com, and you can find all the books and authors we mentioned at stuckinabook.com, or probably in the episode description of wherever you're listening to this. I discovered recently, so there you go.
Thank you so much for listening, everyone.
Bye.